Hi, I'm Lynn Scher in with Todd Zwillick for John Hockenberry. And breaking news this morning from Afghanistan. A military commando raid has freed Stephen Farrell, a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Most of us didn't even know he'd been held captive. For more on the rescue and the backstory, we turn to Eric Schmidt, who is the terrorism correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Eric, welcome. Let's get right into it. Who kidnapped Stephen Farrell and what happened?
Mr. Farrell, who's one of our correspondents in Afghanistan, was seized on Friday after he had he was seized on Saturday with an interpreter outside the city of Kunduz. This was the site of a NATO airstrike on Friday where they exploded two fuel tanks and killed dozens of people, including what Afghan officials say were some civilians.
And I assume he went up there to follow up on that story.
Exactly. He was there interviewing with his interpreter some people, some villagers, when a group of militants calling themselves part of the Taliban seized him and took him and the interpreter away. The driver was able to escape and sounded the alarm. This, in turn, set off a furious kind of manhunt, which led to this military operation, a commando raid, late last night, early this morning, actually, in Afghanistan, where Mr. Farrell was rescued. Unfortunately, the interpreter was killed in the firefight that freed the men.
And who actually carried out the commando raid?
It is believed to be British Special Forces. These are commandos specially trained for these kind of operations. Mr. Farrell has a dual UK and Irish citizenship. And thus, the British commandos took the lead in this operation, apparently, although details are very sketchy still.
And we have a report, I believe the AP is reporting, that one of the British commandos was killed during the operation.
That is my understanding. We still don't know a whole lot about that, but that is my understanding. They're awaiting notification of the next of kin of that service member.
Eric, this is the second time this year that sadly, horribly, a Times reporter has been held captive, but we weren't told about it until afterwards. David Rohde was also kidnapped and then freed. Is this going to make the Times change its way of doing business in Afghanistan?
Well, my colleagues in Afghanistan, as well as other war zones, be it Pakistan or Iraq, always take as many precautions as possible. And I'm sure this whole incident will only redouble our efforts. But we are committed to gathering the story in these kind of very dangerous places, and along with our local partners, in this case Afghan journalists, we'll continue to try and seek the story. But it's obviously a very dangerous environment out there.
And again, as with David Rohde, the Times kept this story under wraps. Obviously, that was for security reasons. Do you think that was the right thing to do?
I think it's borne out. It's been certainly borne out, and was borne out in David's case, and is here borne out in Stephen's case. Although, unfortunately, again, the interpreter was killed. But the belief is that the less media attention given to this, the stakes are not raised unnecessarily in the part of the captors.
Eric Schmidt, terrorism correspondent with our partner, The New York Times. Thanks very much. Good news, Stephen Farrell has been freed. Bad news, his interpreter was killed. Todd?
Okay, let's stick with Afghanistan. Now, Afghanistan's election commission says incumbent President Hamid Karzai now has more than 54% of the votes in the presidential polling there. His nearest rival, Abdullah, has 28%. Of course, the results now have been dogged by allegations of cheating. Afghan election officials say they have clear evidence of fraud, and they've ordered a partial recount. To talk about it now, we're joined by Christine Fair, professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She was recently in Afghanistan as an election monitor. Christine Fair, is there any doubt at all at this point that systematic fraud was an implicit part of this election?
Well, I don't think anyone is saying systematic fraud. I don't think anyone's saying is it top to bottom the entire process was corrupted.
But all of Kandahar seems to have been corrupted. This morning of 14 times as many votes counted as were cast. And
well,
I mean, if Kandahar is so bad,
how systematic fraud? So
okay.
What we do know is that there are there are certainly important locuses of very serious fraud. But to suggest that it's systematic fraud suggests that, you know, the entire national process has been subject to impropriety. And that may be the case, but the evidence is not there.
Okay, fair enough.
But as you noted, in the South, where the security situation was particularly problematic, folks were initially concerned that people wouldn't be able to turn out. But what emerged in the weeks and days prior to the election were various allegations that the Karzai government had, for example, cut deals with Taliban commanders whereby no one would vote, but that the Taliban wouldn't stop ballot boxes being stuffed in return. And this is the kind of thing that you're seeing in Kandahar, where thousands of ballots were turned in, but in fact no one actually turned up to cast those ballots.
Now, this is no doubt putting the United States in a very difficult position, isn't it? We want to support democracy and also security in Afghanistan, plus we have a war on. What sort of damage do you think this election, this faulty election process, is doing to United States interests in our ally, Hamid Karzai?
Well, I put this ticking clock, I set the clock back about a year and a half. The United States international community really tolerated and even facilitated what I would call priming of this system. Karzai, through the Independent Directorate of Local Governance, appointed district and provincial level governors that were very sympathetic. And in fact, observers of this so-called IDLG, which enjoyed U.S. and international financial support, was dubbed the Karzai reelection campaign. So in terms of tolerating using the incumbent's ability to make an uneven playing field, the international community was certainly culpable. And it wasn't really until maybe the last 9 months or so when the international community started thinking, oh, you know, maybe Karzai isn't the right man for the job, at which point, that, you know, as they say, the train had sailed.
So, Christine Fair, let me ask you real quick. We only have a few seconds left, unfortunately. What happens now? Does this whole thing just stay in limbo? Where do we go from here before we get the – while we have this recount?
Well, the bottom line is that there's a precarious line that has to be walked. No one wants to be seen blessing a presidential election that was essentially flawed. In part, that's because we would be seen to be blessing a person that came to power through unlawful means or extra legal means. And in the context of the insurgency, you really want a president that has maximal credibility. Right. So the international community is really at a loss here. On the other hand, the more they impugn Karzai for electoral irregularity, in the likely event that he'll prevail, it's not going to make him terribly inclined to want to work with the United States and the international community. So they're really trying to walk a fine line between getting as credible president out of this process as possible, subject to the reality that whoever comes out of this is going to have to be the partner that the international community works with.
Right, real difficult position for the United States and the U.S. government. Christine Fair, professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown, thanks for joining us. We have just a couple of seconds to catch up on a headline or two, Lynn.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.